David meets Goliath, wrote the local papers, and with good reason. Bloomington High had as many students, 1,200, as the town of Macon had residents. A year earlier, the Purple Raiders had won the sectionals behind the hitting and pitching of a strapping junior named Robin Cooper, advancing to the state tournament before falling in the first round. Now Cooper anchored a deeper, more talented team. Despite playing in a tough conference, Bloomington entered the game 21-6. If that weren't enough to dampen the optimism of Macon fans, word leaked out after the Potomac game. Sweet wasn't going to start Schartzer. It seemed a risky strategy to the reporters on hand. Sure, Schartzer would be throwing on back-to-back days, but he was Macon's star and grittiest competitor. If you had one chance at the biggest game in school history, wouldn't you want your best player on the mound? Sweet smiled when asked about it. "You folks must not understand how we do things in Macon," he said. If he needed a big out or someone for a relief appearance, Sweet assured reporters he wouldn't hesitate to use Schartzer. But he was going to start Henneberry. All season he'd alternated pitchers. What kind of message would it send to the players if he stopped doing it now? That night, in a mobile home 6 miles south of Macon in Mauquia, Bill McClard packed an overnight bag. It had been weeks since McClard had confronted Sweet. There had been no snide comments, no dark stares. Sweet had begun to wonder if McClard felt he'd broken him. Later, he came to wonder if it was the other way around, if maybe it was he who had broken McClard, or in some way helped change him. Because he had changed. In his early years at Macon, McClard had gone out of his way to be an enforcer. Not long after arriving, he expelled a student named Charles Deluge for, as the school board minutes recorded it, complete disregard for the rules and regulations. Then he'd fired Guy Carlton. Back then, as math teacher, Carl Pelker remembers it, McClard served as the perfect combination with Roger Britton. Britton took into consideration the kid and the background, while Bill would nail anybody's butt to the wall. As the years passed, however, McClard had become more lenient. There had been fewer paddles, more stern talks. Eventually, he began to question his role as a disciplinarian. In high school, he'd been a poor student himself. Never took a book home, just barely got by, according to his wife, Vi. He'd always been a dreamer, though, a chaser of windmills. For years, he wondered if he'd missed his calling as a psychologist. He felt he understood kids, and that he knew what was wrong with education. Discipline, he came to believe during his time at Macon, was only one part of the equation. So in the fall of 1970, McClard had started filling out applications for graduate programs. In the spring of 71, he learned he'd been accepted into Ball State's education program, which is how he came to walk into Roger Britton's office and tender his resignation in March. For the sake of continuity, the move wasn't announced, and only a handful of people knew beyond Britton and the board. Sweet was not among them. Now that McClard was moving on, perhaps he came to a realization of sorts. What was the point of staying mad at a guy like Sweet? Why should he be the only one who didn't get to have fun? Besides, McClard was a baseball man. He'd coached the game earlier in his teaching career, and had to admit, if grudgingly, that Sweet was doing an impressive job with the players. It was time to enjoy the ride. So McClard packed up his stuff for a road trip. Macon's team, his team, was going to the sectional finals. He planned on being there. 15. Big Coop. On Friday, May 28th, the Bloomington team arrived at McKinley Field with the full force of its 1,000-strong student body, the members of which soon realized they faced a wonderful dilemma. make fun of Macon for being hicks or for being hippies. In the end, the Bloomington fans chose both. From their bags, they pulled cowbells, which they rang incessantly. They taunted the Iron Men as country rednecks and shouted at Henneberry, "Where did you learn to throw that curveball? Out behind the barn?" The Iron Men had heard it all before. The difference this time was that, as against Potomac, the roar was almost as loud on their side. There in the bleachers were Bob and Scott Taylor and the regulars, now surrounded by roughly 150 of Macon High's 250 students. It sounded like every one of them was cheering. On the far side of the diamond, the Bloomington players warmed up. As they did, one boy stood to the side, long tossing. The ball exploded from his hand. Behind the Macon bench, Bob Schartzer squinted. "Son of a bitch." Schartzer watched a moment longer, then checked the lineup cards. He couldn't believe it. That was Robin Cooper. The same Robin Cooper who'd played for the Bloomington American Legion team against his son's Decatur Legion team the last 2 years and almost single-handedly beat it. 1 year, Cooper pitched a shutout and hit a mammoth shot for the game's only run. And there he was, still in high school. It didn't seem possible. Bob Schartzer knew what he needed to do. He made a beeline for John Henneberry. Down the first base line, Henneberry was warming up and, as he was prone to doing, overthinking. He looked up in the stands and saw his uncle and his cousin. A little farther down, he recognized three other familiar faces. When Mike Atterbury heard the Iron Men had made the finals, he was working a summer job pouring concrete. After begging his boss to let him off work, he joined Brad Roush for the hour-plus drive in Brad's Dodge Polara. Standing next to them, back from Kaskaskia College, was Doug Tomlinson, smiling and clapping. "No," Henneberry thought. "No pressure at all." Just when Henneberry had worked himself into something resembling a nervous wreck, Bob Schartzer appeared in front of him, looking agitated. "You can't pitch to this kid." Henneberry looked at him, startled. "Which kid?" And then Bob Schartzer explained about Big Coop, about how he'd killed Schartzer's American Legion team, which meant that Steve hated him with a deep passion, though that was beside the point. The point was that John absolutely couldn't give the kid anything to hit. "And whatever you do," said Bob Schartzer, "don't throw him a fastball." Henneberry nodded. He might have been nervous before. Now he was both nervous and scared. As he walked to the mound, Henneberry had the same thought as before the Mount Pulaski game, the same thought he always had. Don't start slow. He dug a little divot to the right of the mound, kicking out the dirt. He adjusted his hat. He waved out Dean Otta and, in that slow drawl, said, "I need you to set up just a little more on that outside corner for me now. You set up out there, I'll thread the needle, baby." He looked at his father in the stands and nodded. Then he peered in at Bloomington's leadoff batter, center fielder Brian Bird, knowing the one thing he couldn't afford to do in a game of this magnitude, with all those people counting on him, was start the game off with a walk. He fired one right down the middle. Crack! Bird smacked a single. Then he stole second. Henneberry retired Bloomington's number two hitter, but now he faced Big Coop with a man in scoring position and the cleanup hitter, Mike Abfalder, on deck. Henneberry had planned on following Bob Schartzer's advice and pitching around Cooper, but now he was in a tough spot. If he walked Cooper, then Abfalder would come up with two men on and only one out. Henneberry decided to try to start on the outside corner with an off-speed pitch. Only the ball drifted toward the middle of the plate, as if struck by a sudden gust of wind, and Cooper smacked it for an RBI single to left. Moments later, Abfalder doubled to bring in Cooper. Just like that, it was 2-0 Bloomington. Hanaberry trudged off the mound at the end of the inning, despondent. He'd done it again. Put his team in a hole. Compounding the situation, none of the Iron Men could get around on Bloomington starter John Adams' fastball. One batter after another went down. Miller, Arnold, Schartzer. Through 3 innings, the Iron Men remained hitless. Then, in a fitting metaphor for the afternoon to date, Macon's best bat, the 34-inch Mickey Mantle, cracked under the weight of an Adams fastball in the 3rd inning. It was the Iron Men's 3rd shattered bat of the day. For most teams, this would have been an annoyance. For Macon, it bordered on a crisis. Despite the team's success, the Iron Men were still operating on a tiny budget. Balls were hard enough to come by. Bats were an endangered species. Since they cost $5 or $6 each, the team generally had only 3 or 4 at a time, and usually at least one of those was donated by the parents. In hopes of preserving the team's lumber, Sweet had tried everything, including telling his hitters to hold the bat so that the burned-in trademark symbol, allegedly the weakest part of the bat, faced up when swinging. Thus, the trademark ended up protected on contact with the ball. No one knew if it actually helped, but hey, it sounded good. Usually, the Iron Men broke 1 bat per game, but never 3. Now, 1 Mantle and 2 Nellie Fox bats were toast. All that remained was the 2nd Mantle. Sweet turned to Trusner at the end of the inning. "Sammy, I need you to get us some bats."
"Me? But I'm the first base coach."
Sweet mulled this for a moment, then looked down the bench.
"Hey, Jimmy!"
he yelled toward the end of the dugout, where Jimmy Durbin, the timid freshman with the jug ears, sat with hands on knees.
"How do you feel about coaching first base?"
Jimmy looked around, as if there might be another, more experienced Jimmy sitting somewhere behind him.
"Yeah, you, Jimmy," Sweet said, smiling.
Jimmy nodded, if slowly. There was another problem, though. Trusner needed a ride. Sweet walked over to the stands and explained the situation. When he was finished, an unlikely voice spoke up.
"I'll go."
Standing there, sweating in the sun in his dress shirt and slacks, his hair a bit rumpled, stood Bill McClard. Sweet nodded.
"Sam, you know what we want. Go with him."
So off they went, Trusner and McClard, in search of bats. In the meantime, Sweet told the Macon hitters to make a big show of taking their lone bat back to the dugout, then pretending to assess an unseen stock of choices before pulling the same one out of the bag. The subterfuge they took to with great enthusiasm. The last thing they needed was the Bloomington players knowing they owned yet another advantage. By the 4th inning, Hanaberry had settled down. His curve was snapping, and his fastball was back under his control. Instead, it was Adams who now struggled, as if Hanaberry's shakiness had been a communicable disease transferred between innings. In the 4th, with Bloomington leading 2-1 and Hanaberry stepping to the plate, Adams loaded the bases. Sensing danger, Bloomington coach Bob Spahn signaled to his ace. Over at first base, Robin Cooper nodded and jogged to the mound. In the on-deck circle, Hanaberry watched as Big Coop sent one sizzling warm-up pitch after another into his catcher's mitt. If Cooper was worn out from pitching the semifinal 2 days earlier, he didn't show it. Finally, Hanaberry stepped in. It was the kind of opportunity boys either dream about or dread. 2 outs, bases loaded, 1 run down in the biggest game in school history. As Cooper looked in from the mound, it's safe to say he wasn't worrying about Hanaberry's bat the same way Hanaberry did Cooper's. No doubt Cooper would have been even less concerned if he knew the skinny kid at the plate was using a bat 2 ounces too heavy for him. Around the same time, Henneberry stepped in. Trusner and McClard raced through Bailey and Heim's sporting goods store in downtown Champaign. At the time, sporting goods stores competed with hardware stores, and Bailey and Heim's did its best to set itself apart with service. So when Trusner spoke to the clerk, a man named Rob Carlson, he told him the circumstances and exactly what the Iron Men needed. As Carlson hustled off to find the bats, Trusner worried that McClard might skimp on the bats. When the clerk brought out four, McClard eyed them up as only a former baseball coach can. A 35 mantle, a 34 mantle, and a pair of 33 Nelly Foxes. "We'll take 'em," McClard said. "Let's go." Trusner smiled. "All four?" Aware of the situation, the clerk hustled them out the door, promising to send a bill to McClard. The total, paid out of school coffers later that month, was $20.40. It was the most the administration had spent on the baseball team all season. The first two pitches from Cooper to Henneberry were pure gas. Henneberry fouled one off and watched the other go wide for a ball. From the bench, Schartzer yelled at him, "Keep it steady, Goose! Keep it steady!" When Cooper came back inside with another fastball, Henneberry took a shallow breath, cocked his elbow, and let it rip. To his surprise, he made contact. The ball shot past the second baseman and into right field, deep enough to score a run. In the stands, the Macon students yelled as one. Tie game. At the end of the fourth, the boys jogged back to the dugout, the game still tied. There they were met by the smiling face of Trusner. He stood at the lip of the dugout, brandishing four brand new bats, including Schartzer's favorite, the Mickey Mantle K-55. As proud as Trusner was, one man appeared equally so. Behind the bench, McClard stood, arms crossed, wearing something the boys were unaccustomed to seeing on him, a smile. With Henneberry on the mound, no winning was an easy one. In the bottom of the fourth, with the score tied 2-2, Abfalder came to the plate with runners on first and third and two outs. Instead of trying to jack one out of the park, though, Abfalder hit a perfect swinging bunt down the first base line. Glenn charged the ball and, with no play at the plate, turned and threw as hard as he could to first. Unfortunately, Mark Miller had been playing deep at second and had to race to get to the bag, meaning the ball, Miller, and Abfalder all arrived at almost exactly the same time. Miller lunged for the bag while reaching back to spear the throw barehanded. As he did, Abfalder, a rock of a boy who played fullback for the Bloomington football team, hit first at full speed. Instantly, he transferred all that force into the small body of Miller. On the bench, Sweet cringed. In the stands, the Macon fans held their breath as Miller shot into the air and flew backward. Only, in a remarkable feat of coordination, Henneberry would recount for decades afterward, rather than crashing to the ground, Miller somehow executed a perfect backward somersault and emerged holding the ball aloft in his right hand. The ump looked, paused, and then, with what Henneberry swears was extraordinary gusto, shouted, "You're out!" Macon was still tied. Now it was the Iron Men's turn. In the top of the fifth inning, with Dale Otta on second base, Schartzer grabbed the K-55 and strode to the plate. During two seasons of battling each other in American Legion summer ball, he'd come to detest Cooper for being so talented and confident. Now he stepped in and tried to time Big Coop's fastball. No luck. Cooper got two quick strikes on him. Shortening up on the bat, Schartzer fouled the ball off to stay alive, then fouled off another and another. He scowled out at the mound. One thought stuck in his mind. That big bastard isn't striking me out. Cooper must have been tiring by now. Still, he unleashed another heater, and Schartzer got around on this one.
The ball soared to the bottom of the left field fence. Otta tore around third to score, and now, suddenly, the Iron Men had a 3-2 lead. In the stands, the Macon fans yelled, louder than Swede had ever heard them. In the front row, Bob Schartzer and Dwight Glann couldn't believe it. 6 outs to go. After another scoreless inning from both teams, it came down to this, the bottom of the 7th.